Hello, I'm Dr. Pamela Brewer, and you are listening to Men's Monday here on Mind Talk, the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. On Men's Monday, we focus on all things for and about men.
And today's conversation with someone who has a very interesting take on the workings of the judicial system, or perhaps not so much. David Merkatz is author of Wrongly Charged, A Look at the Legal System. And David, it seems to me that your sense of the judicial system is that there are a lot of places where there, in fact, is no justice. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. Most cases, you're guilty until proven innocent.
David Merkatz, author, again, of Wrongly Charged, A Look at the Legal System. David, you've just said something that many people who look a certain way are used to believing and experiencing. But you don't look like that. You are, in fact, describe yourself to the audience, if you would.
Well, I originally am from Brooklyn, New York. I moved down to South Florida in the early 80s. My profession was a locksmith, and when I moved down to South Florida, I found it odd that there were no licensing regulations of any kind to be a locksmith here in the South Florida area, which makes the business very competitive.
I would think so. David, where were you originally born?
Brooklyn, New York.
Brooklyn, New York. So you're a real Brooklyn baby.
Absolutely.
Okay. I kind of hear it in your voice a little bit. All right, you moved and you had an idea and you had a profession, but when you got to Florida, no licensing? That's really interesting.
Not only is there no licensing, they have what's called a tax certificate that they give out, which I found it very odd when I went in to get one. They don't even ask for a driver's license. So you can go in there and say you want to open up a locksmith business, and just give them a name and no identification and give them $60 and now you're a locksmith. It's really not a license, it's just a tax that you pay to the county.
Okay, so it's okay to pay them taxes, but they don't take any responsibility for ensuring that you are, in fact, a legitimate anything.
Well, in 2010, they tried to put legislation to regulate how the locksmith business works, how it advertises, but unfortunately it never passed. It didn't get far.
Interesting. All right, so how do you go from being Brooklyn-born, moved to Florida, you know, an average guy, you're a locksmith, and now you have written a book and lived a life having to do with being wrongly charged? How did that happen?
Well, I'll give you a brief story of what happened. In the 80s, the locksmith business was fine. We used the Yellow Pages to attract business, and if you had a large ad in the Yellow Pages, you got a lot of calls. But as we got into the late 90s, people stopped using the Yellow Pages.
Uh-huh.
They started using the Internet. And that was good. You went on to, you know, the major search engine, Google, and you paid maybe 50 cents a click, and you were in the top three of Google. But then when all the competitiveness started, and everybody started coming to Florida because here we don't need a license, it was starting to run $40 to $50 a click to be in the top positions in Google.
Oh, my.
And you couldn't make a living doing that. So
well, I was going to say 40 or 50 cents a click. I mean, it's just a click, right?
Yeah.
Somebody
and,
clicks
right,
on your site, and
that could,
yeah. All right, so now it went from 40 or 50 cents a click to $40 or $50 a click.
Correct.
And a click is simply when some person is looking, in your case, for a locksmith, and they click on your website.
Right. That doesn't mean you're going to actually get the job.
Right.
But to be in the top three on Google in this particular industry is very expensive now.
Okay.
So what happened was we couldn't figure out how we can drum up any more business. So a couple of my partners and myself came up with an idea, which probably was not a very nice idea. There's no question it wasn't nice. But what we did is we picked out four or five of the major companies that have been established for probably 15 years. For example, if the name of your company was ABC Lock Shop and Security Center,
okay.
we registered with the state legally ABC Locksmith, and they accepted the registration, and everything was fine. For about 7 years, we actually were getting jobs, leftover jobs that people would call 411 and stuff like that, and they got us instead of the other company. So they weren't too happy about it. They were losing business. But in a normal society, when something like that happens, because these things happen every day, it's a civil matter. They take you to court, and they sue you.
Okay, wait, let me just back up. I want to make sure I have the whole picture. You're in a state where you're a locksmith. You don't have to be licensed to be a locksmith. You do have to pay a tax to the county, so you do that. You actually register the name of your business. And yes, it is almost the same as another business, but not quite. So you are able to register it. But in fact, what happens is you get people coming to your site assuming that you are, in fact, the other site.
Correct. And the interesting thing was, is we checked with three attorneys before we did this, a criminal attorney, a trademark attorney, and a civil attorney. And all of them came back with the same answer. In doing that, the worst thing that could ever happen is the company may sue you for infringing on their name because you registered a similar name to theirs. But the interesting thing was, is when you pulled up our website and you put it next to the competitor's website, they looked nothing alike. We didn't put the same logos on there or anything like that. And at the bottom of the website, we said, we are not ABC Lock Shop and Security Center. Please click here to be redirected. So we were pretty, you know, forthcoming about it. But naturally, the disclaimer was small, like every other disclaimer that
okay.
you find.
Right. All right, so you it's kind of clever. It's not very nice, but it's not illegal. It would seem to me that the fact that you were able to get the name would say that it would be considered legal because you had to go through legal means to actually, you had to apply for the name, right?
Correct, and in fact, the funny part of Florida, we have crazy laws here. The Fictitious Name Act, when you register it, it says right on there, registration under this act does not reserve the name against future use. So what they're trying to say to you is if you're going to register it as a fictitious name, other people can use a similar or close to name unless you trademark it. And these other companies did the exact same thing. They never trademarked their name. All they did was register it under the Fictitious Name Act. So we took advantage of a law
okay.
that was on the books.
Gotcha. And so for a while you were doing fine, sounds like.
For 7 years.
You were doing fine.
Correct. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. There were times where the other competitive company found out through the grapevine that we did a job that should have been their job, and they were unhappy about it. And they tried to do something about it, but nothing ever came of it because the police told them, in a case like this, you really need to file a lawsuit and get an injunction if the judge grants it.
Now, when you say it should have been their job, I think what you're saying is that the folks who hired you thought they were hiring the other company.
Absolutely.
Okay. And you did nothing to dissuade them from that belief, but you made it clear in writing that you were not the other company.
See, the thing is, when the customer would call us, we had no idea because we have a bunch of phone numbers. So if you
okay.
called me up and said, I need my locks changed in West Palm Beach, you've done work for me before, I wasn't going to say, no, we didn't do work for you before because I don't even know who you are.
Okay. Okay, so you would accept that and take the call and do the job and get paid, and folks were getting annoyed. So what happened? So they're annoyed.
Well, you got to also understand that the job we did was the same exact job, same material used, and close to the same price. So the consumer wasn't injured in any way.
Okay.
If we put a lock on for you and charged you $100 and you called the other company, you would have paid between $90 and $110 also. So it wasn't any injury to the consumer.
Okay. All right. So you're giving me all these reasons why what you were doing wasn't illegal.
Correct.
So
unfortunately,
how do you get to be wrongly charged when you're not doing anything illegal?
Now comes the good part of it. In February of 2013, one of the companies that we have been doing it to happens to do all the work for the town of Palm Beach, including the police department, amazingly enough.
Oops.
That was an amazing thing. So what happened was, I guess he contacted one of his good buddies over there, and they set up a sting. And what happened was, we got a phone call from a gentleman in the morning, sometime in February, and he said, we have a lock, we need the lock rekeyed. No problem. So we sent out one of the independent contractors that works in that area, that works for several companies, actually.
Okay.
And he went up there, he knocked on the door, and they let him in, and they said, this is the door here, we need this lock changed, rekeyed to a new key. So he took the lock off the door, took it to his truck, and changed the cylinder in there to make it work on a new key, so the old keys wouldn't work anymore.
Now, was there a name on his truck?
No, there was no name, because like I was explaining to you, he works for several companies.
Okay.
So it's a very common thing in the locksmith business that the independent contractors work for several companies.
Okay.
So he installed the lock back on the door. He handed the person the bill, and it was like $135, if I remember right. They paid him in cash. They tried the keys. And when he walked out the door to go back to his truck, they pushed him to the ground and said, you're now under arrest for burglary of an occupied dwelling, grand theft, and impersonation.
What?
That's what I said.
How did that happen?
Well, it's who you know in this world. And it didn't end there. So now he's in jail. He had to stay in jail overnight because, unfortunately, on a burglary of an occupied dwelling is a serious charge. It's a non-bondable offense. And he had to see a judge to get out, and that's when the saga began. 2 or 3 days later, one of the other independent contractors that had done a job months before got a call from the same detective, and he said, we'd like you to come in, we're conducting an investigation, and we'd like to interview you. And he was a little nervous, and he called me up, and I said to him, listen, if the guy wants to interview you, let him interview you over the phone. I don't really trust him, because what a lot of people don't understand is that during the course of an investigation, the police are allowed to lie to you to get you to come in. But he figured he didn't do anything wrong. Let me go up and cooperate. Well, he went up to cooperate, and when he finished with his interview, they put him in handcuffs. You're under arrest for burglary of an occupied dwelling, grand theft, and impersonation. Same charges.
Okay, let me go back to these charges because, I mean, I'm not an attorney, but these are curious charges to me. Burglary of an occupied house. What did he steal from the... What does he supposedly have stolen from the house?
He stole nothing. But you see, here's the way they get around the law. You know, laws were meant for little loopholes. And the burglary of the occupied dwelling charge, another vague charge, Mr. Smith opened up the door only because he thought you were the other company, or he wouldn't have opened up the door. Now you get it?
So now
so that's
how impersonation.
They try to skirt the statue to say that he broke in because they only let him in because they thought they were the other, you know, company.
Okay, so I get that I get the impersonation piece, but I don't get the burglary of an occupied dwelling and grand theft.
It's going to get more interesting now.
Okay.
You know, when you get arrested for those charges, those are not the formal charges that the state actually files. They review the charges, and they come back within 30 to 45 days, and they can either up-file them, down-file them, or dismiss them. And the interesting part is they actually dismissed the impersonation charge and kept the other two charges on both people.
All right. Now, it seems to me we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I want to pick up here because it seems to me if they dismiss the impersonation charge, then the other two charges couldn't possibly have any bearing. That's just me. I'm not an attorney. We'll be right back, and we'll pick up right here. This is Pamela Brewer, and you're listening to Mind Talk, and I am having a conversation with David Merkatz, author of Wrongly Charged, A Look at the Legal System. Okay, David, the impersonation charge that your two colleagues were was levied against them was dropped. So they were no longer guilty of impersonating another company. So then how are they charged with these other two crimes? I am completely confused.
The burglary charge, it's a very interesting statute. When he knocked on the door, okay, they asked him if he was from the ABC locksmith. And naturally he said yes, because that's the name we had registered. They didn't ask him if he was from ABC Lock Shop and Security, so he agreed to it. And these independent contractors work for so many companies, if they asked him if he was from CBS Locksmith, he would have said yes anyway. Okay. Because he doesn't know the name of the company. He works for many companies.
Okay.
So what they're trying to say in the burglary charge is that they only let him into the premise because he said he was from ABC Locksmith, and they're contending that we were misrepresenting ourselves, and that's how you can get away with filing the charge. Would a jury convict? Probably not, because juries are not stupid. They would have realized that two companies were fighting over a name. Nobody got really hurt. Nobody was broken into. You let him in.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, meanwhile, he's out, legal fees, bail bonds fees, right, and everything until the case comes up for, you know, a court date.
Now, at one point, you used the term a non-bondable offense. There are certain offenses where somebody is not eligible for a bond?
Yeah, well, see, in a white-collar crime, which I actually have a chapter in my book, you can actually get bonded out of jail without seeing a judge. But in a burglary of an occupied dwelling, that's a violent felony. You actually broke into a house where somebody was in there, and that's considered a violent felony. So a judge has to hear that
and see
what really happened. They won't let you out on a standard bond charge. So he had to lay there overnight or in a cell and wait to go to bond court in the morning.
All right. And you talk at one point in your book about an Arthur hearing. I've never heard of an Arthur hearing.
Yeah, there's different types of hearings to have your bond reduced and stuff like that. You know, so you can get out on a lower bond. There's all kinds of different motions you can file. He was pretty lucky because both of these gentlemen never were charged with a crime in their life. So when the judge looked at it, they set a reasonable bond of $5,000 for both of them, so they were able to get out of jail.
Okay. And with a bond, you have to pay 10%, 15%?
10% on a state charge is a normal bond. So right away, with his charges, he had to pay the bondsman, which these charges, even if the case is dismissed, they're not refundable. So you could be paying for these attorney's fees, these court costs and everything like that on a case just because they want to teach you a lesson. And if the charges are dismissed, the state doesn't say, oh, I'm sorry, we filed false charges. Here's your bond costs back. Here's your attorney's fees back. So that's why I stayed in the book.
Huh.
Even if you win, you're a loser.
That's extraordinary. All right. Well, carry us through. You've talked to us about what happened with two of your colleagues. What happened with you?
Okay, see, now months were going by. This happened in February. March went, April went, May went. I heard nothing. But in the back of my mind, I knew that eventually these guys were going to be asked questions, who gave you the job and what happened. So I retained an attorney to have somebody ready for when I felt something was going to happen. And sure enough, in July, my attorney called me and said the detective would like me to come in for an interview. And I said, I don't do interviews. I do interviews on the phone. So he says, well, you're not going to cooperate? I says, absolutely not. He needs to get a warrant. And sure enough, August of 2013, he called me again. He says, I have bad news for you. What's the problem? He says, there's a bench warrant for your arrest. I said, what's the charges? And he says, I can't tell you. He wouldn't tell me. I says, okay.
Wait a minute. Who called to tell you there was a bench warrant for your arrest?
The detective, and I got to be honest, he absolutely was a nice guy, because normally when a detective has a warrant for your arrest, they will come to your home, break your door down, and take you out in handcuffs and embarrass you. But the guy happened to be a nice guy. I got to give him credit. He called up my attorney, knowing I had an attorney on retainer, and said the detective called him and said he has a warrant issued by the court for my arrest.
And I guess I am continuing to be confused, you were being arrested on charges that they couldn't tell you what they were.
Well, I told the attorney to tell him I would surrender in 2 days, and they were fine with that. And during the course of that, with the legal experience that I have, I called my good friend Mark at the Bail Bondsman Company. And in today's electronic society, bail bondsmen have access to things that attorneys and nobody else does. He was able to look it up in the system and make a few phone calls and find out the charges. And the charges were organized scheme to defraud,
wow,
money laundering, and impersonation.
Wow, money laundering?
Oh, yeah, well, that's going to be an interesting story. An impersonation. And the bond is $19,500.
Wow.
I said, okay, great. So what I did was, being smart, I met with the bail bondsman the next morning. We filled out all the paperwork and paid him his fee. And the following morning, I called my neighbor. He drove me up to the main jail in Palm Beach, and I did what's called a voluntary surrender. And when I went to the clerk, she looked at me like, what are you doing here? You know, I just didn't fit the profile. But she looked up the warrant. She says, yes, there is a warrant. And they sat me down, and I got there about 9:30 in the morning, and about a quarter to 10, a police officer came out, and he took me inside. He asked me a few questions, and I told him, you know, what happened, and he was shocked. And he said, you're going to have to wait to be processed. And I said, I understand. I know exactly what the charges were. And about 2 hours later, they called my name, and those were the charges exactly. And he told me what the bond was. Now, here's the thing a lot of people don't understand. You can't make a phone call or do anything until they call your name and the charges are read to you. That's when you are allowed the phone call.
Wow.
Yeah, see, a lot of people are unaware of that. You can sit there for hours. But fortunately, by making those prearrangements,
sure,
the bail bondsman has access to the processing. So as soon as they process you and he sees that the charges were read, they put it in the system, he presses a button because it's already been prepared, and it comes up bonded. And it was like instantaneous bond. I didn't even have to call him.
And the bond was $19,500, so you had to give him $1,950?
Correct.
Okay.
So now, because he bonded it quickly, then you get sent down to what's called to be processed out, okay, which normally takes between 6 and 8 hours. But in my case, because it was done so quickly, knowing the law and how to do things can save you hours. I actually got processed out and released at 3:30 in the afternoon, so I only was in there for 5.5 hours, which was amazing.
That is amazing, particularly when you talk about what other folks have gone through.
That's why I did a whole chapter in the book about how to get out of jail without seeing a judge, because why would you want to spend time in jail, especially for minor crimes, 24 to 36 hours when you can get out within 6 to 8 hours,
right,
if you know what you're doing?
Exactly. And now they have turned you into an expert, unfortunately.
Well, yeah, it was actually, I turned this into a bad experience into a good experience.
Indeed.
And interestingly enough, the same thing happened with me. When the state attorney read through the transcripts and everything, he dropped the impersonation charge also, which I still to this day find very amazing.
Why do you find it amazing? I mean, it seems to make sense. Why do you find it amazing?
Because when they dropped I thought their whole case was that we were impersonating the other locksmith.
Right, yeah, okay, I see.
To drop that charge made me like, then why are you even going after us?
Yeah, then the other charges don't seem to stand, but they stood.
Now, you mentioned the money laundering charge, which is interesting. State money laundering charges in Florida, everybody's a money launderer, because the law reads like this. If you make money off an illegal activity, you're a money launderer. Not if you wash money, not if the money is not, you know, taxable or stuff like that. So, for example, if you're guilty of count one, organized scheme to defraud, the judge would instruct the jury they must find you guilty as a money launderer because you made money off an illegal activity.
I gotcha. Florida is not sounding so great. I mean, you know, a lot of folks have issues with Florida anyway, but it's really not sounding very great.
Now, the other charge, the organized scheme to defraud charge, is also a very, very scary charge to bring in front of a jury. It says if you misrepresented yourself, not if the consumer was hurt in any way, but if you can convince the jury that somehow you misrepresented that you were the other company, then you're an organized scheme to defraud count would stick. And it's a scary thought that if you're guilty of that, then you're a money launderer and you're facing 20 years in state prison for something that goes on every day when someone comes out with a product or a service and someone copies it.
20 years was the possibility?
Yes, because they're both second-degree felonies.
All right, walk us through what happened with you.
Okay, so, you know, naturally, you go back and forth with the state attorney. And the interesting thing was that I found is that they sent my attorney a packet. And the first offer was if I pled guilty to both charges, they would ask for 5 years probation and no jail time. And I found that very interesting from a 20-year sentence.
Right.
So right then and there, I knew that this case was filed out of vindictiveness.
Okay.
Because they were angry that what we did, and they wanted to teach us a lesson.
And they got their friends in the police department to
Correct. That's
move
exactly
this.
What happened.
Okay.
The police officer involved, which I found amazing, actually got an award for this. And this investigation.
He got an award for arresting you guys?
Yeah, he got an award. And the outcome of the cases are interesting that he got an award for this. The money that was spent on this case, they started the investigation in December of 2012. And it went on till my arrest, August of 2013. They hired forensic experts. It was amazing. I read the probable cause affidavit. The amount of money that was spent, it had to be in the millions of dollars.
Oh, my gosh.
Minor. Yeah, that's what they did. I was the front page of the paper.
And this was because you seriously ticked somebody off.
I pissed somebody off. That's exactly what I did. And I always say to this day, what I did wasn't nice. But I turn on the TV every single morning and I hear about songs that are copied by other companies.
Mm-hmm.
The police don't get involved. I hear about cell phone companies stealing an idea from another cell phone company. The police don't get involved. So my thought through this whole process that the worst thing should have happened was they would have filed a lawsuit.
Right. And that's what three attorneys told you. Now, there are some people who would say, you know, if you had to go to three attorneys to get a reading on whether or not what you were about to do was okay, that in and of itself should have told you to back off. What do you say to those folks?
Well, the thing was, that's why I checked with three attorneys, because in the back of my mind, I wanted to make sure that there was no possibility of any criminal charges. I never said what we did, you know, was
okay.
Nice.
Okay, you keep saying that, right. It wasn't nice, but it was legal.
But I got to be honest with you. I'm not sorry for what I did. I see it every time I turn on the news. This one opens up a deli, the next one copies the name, and they make money off of it
right.
Until they get sued for a couple of $1,000. I mean, that's business in the United States. People steal products every day.
It's not a happy reality, but it is the reality.
Correct.
All right. We're going to take a break in a minute, but when we come back, I'm wondering what all of this drama, and it certainly was doing to you as an individual, was doing to your friends, to your family. Just what was going on for you emotionally as you were going through all of this stuff. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back continuing the conversation with David Mercatz, author of Wrongly Charged, A Look at the Legal System. David Merkatz, you know, as I said earlier, many of us are used to hearing stories about persons of color being wrongly charged, thrown in jail, thrown under the jail. I mean, unfortunately, we're used to it with persons of color, but that's not you.
Nope, that wasn't me.
And yet you were wrongly charged, you were thrown in jail, and you were forced to go through all kinds of stuff because you annoyed somebody. So I guess the takeaway from that, at least reality, is that anybody and everybody can be harmed in this way. And quite frankly, it's really easy to do, and it's scary how easy it is to do.
Absolutely. And I went through an emotional period. I mean, I'm thinking to myself, I didn't do anything criminal. And there's no way in the world I'm going to spend 20 years in state prison for something that goes on every day. I mean, there's not a day I don't turn on the news in the morning and I hear somebody came out with a product and this one's imitating it. And it never results in the police getting involved. I don't know if you remember back about a year and a half, 2 years ago, actually while my case was going on, I heard of a case that should have been criminal, and it was also civil. There was a big box store, a very well-known box store, that was taking counterfeit Tiffany engagement rings, and they were boxing them in Tiffany boxes with paperwork and everything and selling them as authentic Tiffany engagement rings. Now, to me, that would have been criminal because the consumer was getting a counterfeit ring,
right,
like a lock that they were getting the exact same thing, and it was from a major, major company out there, and they only filed a civil lawsuit. Now, to me, that would have been a criminal case.
Absolutely. On all kinds of levels.
Never was filed. So I heard that, and I said, how could they come after me when I'm putting in the same exact lock, the consumer wasn't hurt in any way, and most of the consumers, I know I read this affidavit, the probable cause, and they called the consumers up, and, you know, there was a few that were angry, and they were only angry because they went into the store and the other competitor told them that we stole their name. But the average person wasn't angry with us at all. They said, well, he put a lock in, he did a good job. You know, there was no anger at all.
And actually, you didn't steal their name.
That's what I say. Why, the state of Florida could have said, you know what, ABC Locksmith is too close to ABC Lock Shop and Security Center,
right,
so we're not going to register it. Your motion to register it is denied.
Exactly.
And they didn't do that. They took our money for the five companies we did, and they never, you know, said, we could have got a cease and desist letter from the companies. We never got anything. You know, so I don't think what we did, and I still say it wasn't criminal, and I'm not sorry for what I did. I got to tell you, you know, I would do it again.
Well, if it, I hear that you would do it again, and I hear you're not sorry, and I think that there are a lot of folks around who would kind of get what you're saying. But what I'm wondering is, though, that while you were in the midst of this drama, what was happening with you and friends and family? Was your health okay? I mean, this takes a huge toll. I mean, if you had done something, it'd take a huge toll. You hadn't done anything.
It took a toll. But see, everybody supported me. There were a few people that said, you know, I had a couple of neighbors, I'm not going to lie to you.
Okay.
And the neighbors said, you know, that wasn't really nice what you did. But everybody stepped up to the plate and said, you know what, it may have not been nice, but I agree with you 100%. They had no right to prosecute this case as a criminal case.
Okay. So you had a lot of support, which made, I am sure, a huge difference for you as you were going through all of this. How long did you actually go through all of this?
Well, on the other two gentlemen, interestingly enough, with all the money and everything that was spent, all charges were dismissed, which is not a surprise.
Okay.
Not a surprise at all. No sorry, no nothing, $20,000 apiece in attorney's fees, not refunded. Reputations damaged all over the internet. In my case, they had spent so much money on this case that they did not want to dismiss the charges.
Okay.
I could have elected to go for a trial. And I looked at the laws, and I did a lot of legal research on them, and I was a little bit afraid because, again, what I did wasn't nice. And I said to myself, a trial was going to be an additional $35,000, which a lot of people don't understand, that even if they come back with a not guilty verdict, you still don't get the $35,000 back.
And that was $35,000 in legal fees for you?
On top of the $60,000 that was already spent to start the defense.
Wow. Okay.
So now I'm looking at $95,000, and there's always a possibility that the jury could find you guilty. I mean, there's 100 people a day that get found innocent for crimes that they did commit. But right. There are people that actually go to jail for crimes that they didn't commit because the jury might not like them for whatever reason, and that was frightening. So finally, and that's why there's people plead guilty to crimes they didn't commit, because of fear and money. If I didn't have the $35,000 to waste, and the fear factor of possibly being found guilty is scary, 20 years in prison. So they finally came up on Valentine's Day of 2014 with, I would say, an offer I couldn't refuse. They said, plead guilty to a petty theft charge with an adjudication withheld, which basically means no criminal conviction after the probationary period, and will drop all felony counts against you. And I thought to myself, too sweet of a deal to turn down. Petty theft, adjudication withheld, so I decided to accept the plea.
Now, what does it mean, adjudication withheld?
Adjudication withheld means you're not convicted.
Ah, okay.
So, I mean, it's on your record, but you could never be... Well, first of all, it's a misdemeanor, so misdemeanors are not a big thing, and it's not a violent misdemeanor, domestic violence or anything like that, so it would never bar any licensing or anything like that.
Okay.
But with a withheld, you're technically not convicted of the charge.
All right, so they offered you a pretty sweet deal, given that they had spent tons of money trying to convict you.
They wanted to do something, and if I didn't accept the plea, here's the problem. When you go to trial, judges are very funny. You know, if you don't take the plea, and I actually have unfortunate case like that in my book, if you don't take the plea, they usually sentence you, if you're found guilty, to almost the maximum penalty.
If you don't take the plea, wow.
Correct. There's a sad story of somebody in Boca Raton, Florida, that was in a vehicular homicide.
Yeah, tell that story. That was a very interesting story. Tell that story.
Well, there was a gentleman that was diabetic, unfortunately, and he was speeding, and he was coming home. He was 5 minutes from home, and he hit a car, and unfortunately, he killed 5 elderly people in the car. He stopped his car, tried to render aid, but, you know, he waited for the police. They took blood samples. There was no alcohol, no nothing. It was a tragic accident.
Okay.
Unfortunately, he was speeding, so he, you know, was doing something wrong. And they offered him 5 years in state prison as a plea. And the guy was like, but it was an accident. I wasn't drinking and driving. I stopped. I didn't leave the scene. And he had one of the top attorneys.
Okay.
And he went to trial. And believe it or not, he lost the case. He appealed the case, spent, I'm going to say $100,000 or more on this case. And unfortunately, the appeal he lost. And the judge sentenced him to the maximum penalty, not the 5 years, because he exercised his constitutional right for a trial. He sentenced him to 15 years. And unfortunately, he doesn't get out till April of 2016. It was a tragic story.
And by the time he gets out, he's been in jail for 15 years.
And the funny part of it was, a week after that happened, in another town in Davie, just goes to show you how justice doesn't always work, a teenage girl, 19 years old, was driving, and she hit the woman in the rear. She plowed into a car, a pregnant woman, and knocked her into a canal. And she drowned, and the baby died.
Oh, my gosh.
You know what she was sentenced to?
I'm afraid
careless
to ask.
Driving, a careless driving ticket, no charges.
What?
So, and I looked at that case and I said, here she hit the person in the rear, also, you know, made a mistake. She stopped also and rendered aid. And she got a careless driving, a suspension for 1 year, and no criminal charges were ever filed. So I looked at that case and I felt so bad for this guy because he actually was one of my customers and a very nice guy.
It doesn't sound like justice in the justice system.
It depends on the judge. It depends on the prosecutor. If they got a thing for you, they actually had a thing for me. But in the end, I don't think they would have gotten a conviction. But to spend $35,000 and always, even if it's a 10% chance, I'm not going to get that money back.
Right. That's right. Now, you talk about two judges in your book who actually committed crimes, and they were treated very differently from the average citizen. And I think with both of them, they were driving incidents, weren't they?
Yeah, there was a famous judge in, she's actually a Broward County judge, and this is not her first offense, I want you to know. She was driving in Boca, and she was driving erratically. She had just gotten out of a judge's convention or something, and somebody spotted her. They didn't know she was a judge and called 911 and told her she was driving erratically, and they pulled her over for a traffic stop, and she was arrogant. There's actually a video link in my book. And they asked her to step out of the vehicle and do this and do that. And she said, I will not. And this is a judge.
Oh.
This is a judge. And she knows the law. She
right.
Be, you know, stepping out of that vehicle and cooperating.
She refused.
She refused. She said, you will wait. If you play that video, you will see it. You will wait till my attorney gets here.
Wow. And so what happened?
So what happened was, here's the interesting thing. A normal person wouldn't have this kind of luck. They finally wound up offering her a plea deal to a misdemeanor with a year suspension of her driver's license and a little community service and, you know, nothing major. She turned the plea down. Now, normally, if that was you or I that turned the plea down and went to trial, they would give you a year in state prison, the maximum penalty.
Okay.
Well, she went to trial and lost, and the only difference was that she got is she got 6 months house arrest and the same charges.
Extraordinary.
And she's still a sitting judge, I want you to know.
Wow. All right, so clearly there's justice and no justice, and in the scheme of things, it doesn't sound like there's justice at all. Because if honestly, if there's justice for one and not for the other, then there's not justice.
Yeah, well, there's a way to put a stop to this. There is a way to put a stop to this. And well, the way would be if we started treating criminal cases similar to the way we treat a civil case. If I sue you for something and I win, I can ask for court costs and attorney's fees.
Okay.
Can you imagine if the prosecutor knew that, because there's no question he knew these were charges that should have been a civil matter. If
okay.
he knew all along that he would have to pay back the two gentlemen and myself for all court costs, attorney's fees, and bond costs if he lost the case, we both know he would never have filed the charges.
That's very true. David, we're going to take a break, and we're going to be right back, and I want to hear more about what you think needs to be different to change the judicial system. We'll be right back. David, there, I actually was pleased that there is at the back of your book a glossary of terms, because there are certainly a number of terms that you use that, quite frankly, I had never heard of. Now, one of them that I'd not heard of, but that I would like for you to explain, is a certificate of relief of disabilities. What is that?
Okay. If you're, you know, have a conviction for a crime, okay, And a lot of people have made mistakes in life. Some people got caught and some people didn't. Maybe you shoplifted or something like that. And unfortunately, a shoplifting charge can be a grand theft charge in most states if it's over $500 or $1,000. And, you know, a lot of people have done it in their life. Some have gotten caught. Now you get older, you realize you made this mistake, but you have a felony conviction. Now, in certain states like Florida, if it's a withheld adjudication, you can have the case sealed or expunged. I actually teach that. But unfortunately, where I'm from originally, in the state of New York, is a non-expungement state. So basically, that stays with you forever. Now imagine I wanted to go for a stockbroker's license or a real estate license, and I made a mistake at the age of 22, and now I could never get it because I'm a convicted felon.
Okay.
You can apply, and it's quite easy to do and quite inexpensive, for what's called a Certificate of Relief of Disabilities. And what that is that the court grants it in most cases, especially on a white-collar crime, if you've completed your probation and you hadn't gotten in trouble in a year or so. It basically means that no state, county, or municipality can use it against you and deny you any license, which is excellent. So now you can apply for that, even a pistol license in most cases.
Wow.
If you have your civil rights restored, you can mention that you have the felony conviction, you submit the Certificate of Relief of Disabilities, and they cannot deny you. It's an amazing thing.
So you could get a driver's license back, perhaps a professional license. Could you vote?
Absolutely. That's the only thing that you can't do with most certificates, and there are exceptions even to that, is you can't run for public office. But there are exceptions. There are certificates. There are mayors that have been committed, you know, something wrong, and they've got reelected because they got the Certificate of Relief of Disabilities.
I see. And you say that it's also known as civil rights restoration. It's the same thing.
Most states, if it's not a violent, rape charge, it's just a white-collar crime, it's very easy to do. It takes a little knowing, but it's something that you can get your professional license, because otherwise, what do? You made a mistake at 22 or 23. You got caught shoplifting.
Right.
Now, for the rest of your life, you can't earn a living.
But if it's a violent charge, no matter what age you were when that charge was filed against you, you cannot apply for a certificate of relief. It's only
you
if it's...
You can. It depends what it is. If it's a sexual charge, it might be hard.
Okay.
But even there are issuing them now, even for burglary or as long as nobody got killed, most times you can get the certificate.
Wow. That's extraordinary information, and I don't know that many people really know that.
Oh, a lot of people don't know that you can actually seal or expunge a record, because let me give you an example. Imagine a couple of days ago here in the South Florida area, on a Facebook page, it was a well-advertised story, this Spanish guy, they saw his picture on Facebook, and there was a woman that got raped, and his picture looked like it. They arrested him and charged him with rape and kidnapping and all kinds of charges, and he spent 42 days in jail, $7,500 in legal fees, and they apologized to him the other day and released him due to DNA evidence. But unfortunately, here's his problem now. Could you imagine he comes to an employer now for a job,
right,
and they run his name. It's going to have his name, Miguel, on there. He was charged with aggravated kidnapping and rape, case dismissed. Not too likely the employer is going to hire him, because they still look at you like a criminal.
Absolutely. And there's so many reasons why a case could be dismissed that they might still see you as being guilty.
Right, because they don't put the notes in the... And unfortunately, in the system we have today, even if the charges are dismissed, they don't take it off the record. You know, they say, well, it's dismissed. But that doesn't matter. Still, people still look at you. He's all over the Internet, and they don't put the good stuff, only the bad stuff on the Internet. So what happens is, now in Florida, he can have his case sealed or expunged, so it'll be completely removed. And anything that's on the Internet, once the order is signed, will be ordered that Google must take it off.
And does Google comply in those instances?
If it's a court order, they have to comply. Yeah,
okay.
The judge signs an order. It may take a month or two, but you will get it off. And the thing is, once you have that off your record, now nobody can see that you were ever arrested for that, because that's a scary thing to have for the rest of his life now. If he goes for a job, that's a serious charge. It's not like a petty theft charge. You know, this is a serious, scary charge that nobody would hire him for.
Now, you're saying sealed or expunged. Are those interchangeable, or do they mean different things?
Well, sealed means the records are sealed. They can be reopened in certain instances, but nobody can see them except the judge. Expunged, you have to get the state attorney's approval for, which takes a little bit longer, and they're physically destroyed. Now, the difference is one, you have to get the state attorney's approval for, but in a dismissal, they can't deny it. It's very hard for them to deny an expungement on a dismissal.
Okay.
But in an adjudication withheld, they may not want to grant it, but most of the time they will. It's just that it takes a lot longer on an expungement versus a sealing.
Okay, so here we are, and you and I are talking about huge disparities in the criminal justice system. Huge. What's the way to fix this?
Like I said before, you know, prosecutors would be less likely to file charges and research the case a lot more before they actually filed the formal charges if they knew they were going to have to pay for these dismissals and reimburse this poor guy the $7,500 and maybe pay him $100 a day for 42 days he spent in jail. They might have checked it out a little bit further, where this way they just use, you know, it's no big deal to them. This guy's in jail, and the judge apologized to him. I'm very sorry, and he walks out, and he's out $7,500, and he couldn't even bond out of jail because obviously aggravated kidnapping and rape is a non-bondable offense.
I gotcha.
So it's a scary thing.
And do you think that if that was the case, that is there anything else that needs to be done, or would that kind of do it? I mean, would
that would do it?
Wow.
If they knew that they were going to have to pay both sides in an acquittal by a jury, they would not file these cases that were borderline. My case was a borderline case. There was no question that it was a civil matter. I guarantee you they tossed it over. That's why it took so long before they actually filed the charges. I mean, these first two guys were arrested in February, and mine took till August. And they must have had a lot of pressure from these locksmiths saying, hey, do something to this guy. Teach him a lesson. But they probably were borderline filing it. But if they knew they would have had to pay my attorney back $60,000, the bond costs, and maybe reimburse me for some suffering that I went through, and what about paying the other two guys back? They would have been out about $150,000 in fees, and they would have to account for that. They wouldn't be so fast to file these frivolous charges.
Gotcha. What's going on in your life today?
Well, I'm promoting my book. I'm helping other people. I'm actually donating 10% of the profits of this book to help anybody else that's been wrongly charged.
Huh.
The sales have been actually doing very well in the past few weeks. And then I'm going to start another book next year.
And clearly, there's been so much that's been going on in the country nowadays in terms of law enforcement or the lack of law enforcement. Will your next book be along the same lines, or are you doing something entirely different?
Well, I'm actually going to do a book strictly on life after a conviction, because there are a lot of people that don't realize in detail which states you can seal and expunge, and how to get yourself, how to rebuild your reputation. Because unfortunately, my reputation was ruined all over the internet and everything. They wrote all kinds of nasty things, you know. And it's very hard to recover from it, especially if you're not a self-employed person.
Right.
How could you get another job? People won't hire you.
Exactly. So with you, what is, I mean, that second book sounds like it's an important book. With you, though, today, are you working? Are you able to support yourself?
Well, I'm doing, starting an organization, actually, in the next few weeks to help people that are wrongly charged and wrongly convicted. I'm going to get a bunch of attorneys together that will work for lower fees to help people that can't afford. Because in this world, unfortunately, the minorities that can't afford spend this time in jail because they can't. Some people can't even afford that $2,000 or $3,000 to bond out of jail. And
That's
they sit
right.
there for 45 days till the bonds are reduced. It's a terrible thing.
Right. Right. What about locksmithing? Have you given that up?
Yes, I gave that up. I'm doing better with this now.
The company or companies that were really behind pushing this whole thing along, have you had any interaction with them?
they're actually jealous that I turned this situation into a book. And, you know, when I disclosed all the names of everybody involved in the book, I actually had to get a court order to do that because one of the conditions that I had was a probation, and they didn't like the idea that I would come out with a book and disclose everything. And fortunately, the judge was on my side and said it needs to be disclosed.
Wow.
And I got a court order. So, you know, once that court order was issued, I went all over the airwaves with it.
And you wrote the truth and nothing but.
Nothing but the truth. Again, I know, like I said from the beginning, I never said what I did was nice, but it wasn't criminal, and that's what counts.
Gotcha. David Merkatz, author of Wrongly Charged, A Look at the Legal System. Give us your website and all your contact information.
Okay, the website is www.wronglycharged.com.
Okay.
The book is available at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and Books A Million. We have a toll-free number, 844-WRONGLY, if anyone has any questions. And like I said, 10% of the profits of the book are being put together to help other people.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much, David. I am sorry that this was an experience that you went through, but you've certainly turned it around, and you're giving folks much-needed information. So thank you for that. And
Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. Thank you for joining me today on Mind Talk. And folks, thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other profession. Mind Talk is available on demand at mindtalk.org. That's MYNDTALK.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. But the best way to be in touch is at MYNDTALK@AOL.com. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.